Hello, I'm Will Shires and this is Talking Trucks. In this episode, I'm going to be chatting with Scania UK's new MD, Chris Newitt. And on this occasion, he's going to be answering commercial motor reader questions. It's part of our Grilled in the Caff series of interviews and was recorded over a fry-up at the Junction 23 truck stop, hence the background noise. You'll be able to read the full interview in the 16th of February issue of Commercial Motor and also see the Scania 770S he turned up in.
Chris, thank you for joining me at the Junction 23 truck stop and agreeing to be grilled in the car. I've got a nice set of questions here for you.
Looking forward to it.
Excellent. So tell me, how long has it been now? It's only 4 or 5 months, isn't it?
Just over 3 months I've been enrolled. So it's, time has gone amazing. It feels like 3 weeks, really, but it is. It's just over 3 months.
Okay, and how are you finding it? How has the switch been from cars and trucks? Because you've had a life working from Volkswagen and Jaguar Land Rover.
Jaguar Land Rover, yeah. I think what actually struck me was all the similarities, actually. Certainly in my responsibility in passenger cars, I've always been responsible for, if you like, the business-to-business, the fleet relationship. And the business-to-business relationship for passenger cars is very similar to the business-to-business relationship in trucks. The difference is that might be 20% of your business, whereas in the truck industry, it's 100% of your business.
Yeah.
But, you know, having been out to a number of the sites, you know, the workshops work in exactly the same fashion. There is absolutely no difference. The trucks are much, much bigger. Slightly surprisingly, the special tools to fix them actually are surprisingly about the same size, actually. I was expecting them to be proportionately bigger as well. But it's the similarities that struck me rather than the fundamental differences. There are differences, but actually they're an awful lot alike.
So do you think your car background puts you at an advantage or a disadvantage?
I'm a bit biased, so I would say I think it puts me at an advantage. The reason why, though, is if we look at what's happened in the world, you know, COVID, chip shortages, Russia and Ukraine, logistics problems, Brexit, driver shortages and everything else, we've seen a huge amount of external change. And I think someone coming in with a fresh perspective who isn't wedded to, well, we've always done it this way.
Yes.
I think as we look forward, we know there's some long-term things that the industry has to face, digitalization, sustainability, electrification, and so on and so forth. And then there will be other external factors that we've got to tackle. And so I think someone who you know, understands and cherishes what's important, you know, brand and the culture of the company and so on and so forth, but isn't wedded to operational practices, we've always done it that way, I think is, and brings a fresh perspective, I think is an advantage to face some of those challenges and help with the evolution that we'll require.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so what could the car industry learn from the truck industry?
I think one of the things that the truck industry does brilliantly and the car industry doesn't is it views every customer relationship as a longer term thing. It doesn't view it as a single transaction. It views it as a long term relationship.
Yeah.
And so therefore the solutions it puts in place when something goes wrong are part of a longer term relationship. It's ingrained within its culture and the way it thinks. Whereas in the passenger car industry, they go, you're a customer, you're broken down, we'll solve that problem. Could be your first car, could be your 10th car, doesn't matter. The solution is based on you are broken down in that particular moment at that particular time.
Yes.
And that's not how the truck industry works. And I think the car industry, if it could, it's the single biggest thing I think it could do to transform the relationship with its customers is that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. Right, now, here's a really tricky one for you. The V8 has been a phenomenal success, great marketing tool for Scania, and truck shows are full of people wearing V8 and T-shirts and baseball caps. And this guy here says he's even got a V8 tattoo. How long has the V8 got left, and what will its demise do to Scania's image? And this guy says, I for one won't be getting a tattoo of a Scania battery.
Oh, well, I won't ask to see his tattoo. But I think that's a great question. I really do, because I think it gets to the nub of the challenges that traditional manufacturers face as we move towards electrification and sustainability.
Yeah.
because a traditional manufacturer has based it on its engineering heritage, its this, that, and everything else. What I would say, though, is that that engineering heritage, that sub-brand, in this case a V8, but whether it's a Ferrari V12 or Porsche's Turbo, it has come to mean something more than that. He hasn't got a V8 tattoo just because it's got eight cylinders in a V configuration. He's got it because it means something more than that. To him, it means the best. It's the pinnacle. It's the most powerful. It's the smoothest. It's the most refined. That's why he's got the V8, not just because it's got eight cylinders, because there's loads of engines out there with eight cylinders. He's not celebrating that. He's celebrating what it means.
Yes.
And, you know, I absolutely trust my colleagues over in Sweden to make the right decision, just as you can buy an electric Porsche with a turbo on it. That's the badging, because everyone knows that turbo, based off an engineering history associated to the 911, that's the fastest, it's the most powerful, it's the best. So they've carried on using turbo. It hasn't got a turbo on it. That's not the point. That's what it comes to mean. So my colleagues over in Sweden will make that decision as to what we do with the V8 brand. It's a fantastic brand. We should cherish it. But the good news is they don't have to make that decision in the near future. They've got plenty of time to make that decision. But it is something that the traditional manufacturers have to make those kind of decisions. But Porsche, Audi have done it as well. You can buy an electric e-tron with RS, and so on and so forth. So it's perfectly possible for these brands to live and breathe in the future.
Yeah. Right. What changes have you made so far, and will you be making in your new role?
That's a good. It's interesting in that, you know, I view my role. I've got a fantastic privilege. The Scania brand existed long before I turned up, and it will exist long after I've gone. I am a caretaker for a period of time.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to say, well, what changes are the MDs gonna is an MD gonna make? Actually, part of my job is to keep stuff as well. You know, I have to make sure that in a world that is changing, as we go on a journey towards a more sustainable future, as we go on a journey to a more digitalized future, plus handling all the kind of short-term, you know, challenges that will be faced against us, I've got a duty to keep what is great as much as I've got a duty to change and help adapt and everything else. So, you know, undoubtedly, longer term, we will need to do more digitalization. We will need to go on a journey towards a more sustainable future. We will need to decarbonize our sites. These are all the things long term that we need to do. But I'm as interested in keeping and cherishing and preserving what makes Scania great as much as I am about changing stuff. I'm a temporary, you know, keeper of this fantastic brand, and you know, I hope I get to do it for many years. But even if I was to do it for 10 years in the history of Scania, it's a tiny tenure, really. But yeah, it's as much about keep as it is about change.
Now, you've turned up today in a stunning 770S, but you were in the passenger seat.
I was.
So, safe to assume you don't have an HGV licence?
No, I don't. We have talked about it. Personally, I'd love to do it. I think it would be absolutely brilliant to be able to do it. But the honest answer, it's not going to make me a better business person. It's not going to make me a better MD. You know, will I fulfill that personal ambition? I hope so, but I'm not going to put a timeline on it or anything else. And equally, you know, once I've got it, would I really use it? I mean, you know, it's a nice badge to have, but it would in reality be a badge. But I would be a badge I'd love to have, let's not kid ourselves, because it's what a fantastic machine, it really is.
Okay. I've been driving a new 450S for 4 months, and I'm not impressed. The level of standard equipment is far below other makes. It seems that everything apart from the chassis, engine, and wheels is an optional extra. How do you justify such high purchase prices?
I think, you know, and I'm sure that customer has also done exactly the same thing, because otherwise they wouldn't have ended up buying a Scania. The purchase price is just one element of the ownership experience of the truck, and picking his words, if the chassis, the engine, and the wheels in 3 years' time or 5 years' time are worth the premium at a residual value disposal level, then the value of that ownership experience is the same or better when you take into account the fuel economy, the durability and the running costs and everything else. And, you know, Scania's reputation is built off the overall ownership costs and its durability and its running and its residual values. It's not built off of the singular purchase experience, because, as I said on one of the other questions, the ownership experience goes beyond, you know, just that single transaction. We have to look at it as a long-term relationship, and that's what we do. And that means, yeah, you do have to pay a bit more upfront, but trucks are worth so much more when you look to dispose of them, and they've got a great reputation for durability. They're loved by drivers, and they've got fantastic operating costs as well.
Okay. So as we've established, you turned up in the truck today.
Yes.
If you hadn't have done, what's your daily drive? And more importantly, what's in your garage?
Ah, okay. Well, so my daily drive is I drive an Audi e-tron. Okay. I think they're just rebadging it to an Audi Q8 e-tron. Which is fantastic. And I've been driving electric cars for, I don't know, 4, maybe even 5 years now.
Well, that's probably a really early adopter then.
Yeah, and it's amazing to see how much it's transformed. You know, 4 years ago, public charging, completely different to today. You know, couldn't find a 150 kilowatt charger, and you know, if you couldn't charge at home, I would have said, be careful. Now, absolutely fine. In the garage, I've got... it was my dad's car. It's a Daimler SB250. It's a V8, of course.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, and it's been in the family almost since new. Someone owned it for 9 months before my father did. So I've known it when it was just a car. It wasn't a classic car, it was just a car. And it was the only car my dad had for many, many years. And then as it got older, he kept it and it kind of became a classic car. And then sadly, when he passed away, I inherited it. And it's been in the family ever since.
So it's early 60s then, yeah?
Yeah, I think it was built in 61, but it's been in the family since 62.
And does it get much use?
A reasonable amount. Yeah, my daughter and I, we didn't know it was going to be at the time, but we booked a few days away down in Bath, and we went off in the Daimler. We just so happened we booked it on that hottest weekend of the year last year, so when it was like 38 degrees. So, but it ran absolutely fine. You know, there were modern cars, you know, breaking down and couldn't take the heat, and this just sailed through. I mean, it was pretty hot. You know, there's no air conditioning.
No,
there's not a lot of heat insulation between you and the engine either. So, in 38 degrees, it was pretty warm.
Yeah, that's not pleasant.
But we had a fantastic time.
Brilliant. Right. What was your perception of Scania before you joined the company, and has it since changed?
My perception before I joined, I knew it had a great brand, I knew it had a great reputation, I had been told that it was very customer centric, so lots and lots of positives. The bit that's changed, because it's become real to me, not necessarily because it's changed, is there is a real sense of Scania family. The passion from the customers, you know, until you speak to the customers, until you see them, you know, making their office reception desks Scania cabs and so on and so forth, you can't really understand that. And the same within the Scania employees, this sense of the Scania family is, it's absolutely real and tangible, and you feel it. I felt it from the minute my announcement was made. There were people from around the world who worked for Scania who I'm probably never going to meet, reaching out and going, welcome to the family, it's fantastic to have you on board and everything else. And I've genuinely never experienced anything like that in my career.
Scania has made it clear that it won't be going down the hydrogen fuel cell route. What about hydrogen combustion? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were the first manufacturer to actually be running hydrogen test heavy truck units. We do see a future for hydrogen. So I don't think Scania is going, nope, there is no future for hydrogen going ahead. What we've made clear is that we're very clear on the next step is about renewable fuels, and it's about the direct electrification. We view that as, that's very clearly the next step.
Yep.
But we'll continue to test hydrogen. We'll continue to learn from it. You know, Scania is renowned for offering you know, a massive range of options in terms of fuel types and power and so on and so forth, and we'll continue to learn from hydrogen, and we're quite sure that it will have a future, but the focus on the next steps is on renewable fuels and electrification.
Yeah, but Scania seems to be sort of hedging its bets, put in so many camps. You've got your full electrics, you've got your hybrid,
yes,
your gas,
And I think it is. Again, people say, well, I would say that. Well, yeah, I would say it, but because I think it allows us to be a trusted advisor to our customers. We're not picking a type of technology and then going, now let me convince you that is the right answer for your business. Because if it's not the right answer, you can't do business with us. We offer the massively broad range, as you've said. We've got a foot in pretty much every camp. And I think that does allow us to sit down with our customers and say, let's look at your business, let's look at your usage and make a recommendation that is right for your business. Yeah. As opposed to, I only offer 30%, so let me convince you that what I offer is right for you.
Okay. When do you envisage your electric trucks to have a price parity with diesel?
Again, another very good question. And I think the two aren't really connected. You know, the government could pass legislation now that would be very anti-diesel trucks. That means its residual values would collapse, and it would reach parity tomorrow.
Yes.
So to link electrification cost to diesel cost isn't necessarily the debate that should be having. The question is, and I pick it in an urban environment. In an urban environment, there will be cases today where it makes more sense to run an electric truck than it makes to run a diesel truck.
Yeah.
But if you're hauling stuff up and down motorways and across continents and so on and so forth, it won't make sense. And the point at which you reach parity, using their term, will vary based on usage and type of truck and so on and so forth. So there isn't, I can't answer, I can't pick a date. I'm not a fortune teller. If I was, I'd probably use it to pick six numbers, but rather than anything else. But it's not really the debate of when it hits parity. It's when is electric the right solution, and when is diesel the right solution, or any other fuel train.
Yes. Okay. A bit different, this question. What three people, dead or alive, would you most like to have dinner with, and why?
Well, first up would be my dad. He passed away in my early 20s, and I think one of the things I'd encourage everyone is because I can't do it, is I knew him as a dad. I never really knew him as a man. I'm sure, you know, he was a management consultant. I'd love to have a conversation with him about my career and my business and use him as a sounding board, because he was a businessman as well. And I think so many people go through their lives always viewing their parents as, well, their parents. And I'd encourage anyone to get to know your parents as people, as adults. So having dinner with my dad would definitely be one of them. I think another one would be Freddie Mercury.
Really?
Yeah. The first live band I ever saw was Queen at Wembley Stadium on the Kind of Magic tour.
Yeah.
And my youngest daughter is 15, and I said, right, you should go to a proper concert, and we'll take you to your first concert. Who do you want to go and see? And she said, Queen. Now, okay, Freddie Mercury wasn't there, but there's just a fantastic, that my first live band, it's kind of scary as well, the first band I saw and the first band she saw live was the same band. But legend has it, he can throw a great party as well, so I'm sure.
I'm sure
that'll be a fun evening. And then I love Formula One, so I'd go any one of Stirling Moss, Jenson Button, or James Hunt. I think they've all got stories to tell, and they're all pretty well known for being great company. So any one of those three for the last one, and then the first two.
Fantastic. Are you a good boss?
Oh, I'm biased. I mean, I think probably anyone who's got to this stage of their career, and you're asking these questions for, isn't a bad boss. I'd like to think that the industry would have capped them at an appropriate level. The feedback I get from my teams is has always been positive, and there's I get great pleasure in seeing people who worked for me are now directors or MDs in the automotive industry. I'm hugely proud that I had a tiny part in their career development. But really, you need to ask them. But I think I'm okay.
Good, I'm sure you are. On the subject of directors, how many women are there on the Scania UK board?
There's two. So our people and culture director and our transformation director are both women.
So it's two out of...
It depends how you cut it, but it's either 7 or 14, or 13 if you include the retail side of the business.
Are you happy with that mix?
I think from a sheer numbers perspective, I'd like a more diverse first line, but it has to be... the right. I don't believe in positive discrimination, and I think anyone who's worked for me knows that you have to be the best candidate for the job.
Yes.
But there is undoubtedly, if you've got a diverse and mixed team, I think you get different views, different perspectives, and you make better decisions as a consequence. So it's not something I'm going to actively go out and seek, but it would be lovely if we can make it happen and the best candidates can add more diversity to the first line.
Okay, and finally, last question, hobbies. Tell us about you. What do you do to unwind?
I shouldn't really have to think, but I do love Formula One. I also love movies. So my daughter and I go to the cinema a lot. I've got a room filled with movie memorabilia and kind of signed photos of film stars and various other bits and pieces. As we've already touched on, the Daimler Dart keeps me occupied.
Yeah.
It's nice to head out. I'm not one to go to... I do quite like going to classic car shows and various other bits and pieces, but people, want to talk about the car, whereas I just want to wander around and look at nice cars and, enjoy the day and various other bits and pieces. And that kind of, those keep me occupied outside of just being... a dad and a husband and an owner of two dogs and so on and so forth.
And I hear you're a bit of a chef as well.
Yeah, I do like cooking. I mean, certainly if it comes, if we've got guests, almost invariably I'm the one doing the cooking. I do most of the cooking at the weekends, less in the weeks purely because of work and hours and everything else. But yeah, the feedback generally is I'm reasonably good at cooking. No one's fallen desperately ill yet, at least.
That's good. On the subject of good cooking, how were your scrambled eggs?
They were delicious. Very, very nice. All the better for the brown sauce as well.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time.
Hey, you're welcome. Fantastic.
Cheers.
Thank you.